From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Hey, welcome back, guys. Nice to have you back.
Nice to be
nice
back,
to be
Don.
With you, Don.
Okay, so let's see. Monday is the opening of the general debate. There'll be 39 heads of state speaking, including President Obama, President Xi Jinping from China, President Vladimir Putin from Russian Federation, the President of Cuba, the President of Zimbabwe, and the head of the African Union this year, Robert Mugabe. It's going to be an interesting day. You guys want to start talking about it? And I think, Mark, this week it's your turn to open.
Yeah. A backdrop for everything that's going to happen is the Russian military intervention in the Syrian conflict, which, while Russia was always providing advisors on a small scale with the hardware that they were sending to Syria and with long-standing defense contracts, escalated in the last 3 weeks. And I don't think I'll have any disagreement from either of you gents that this was a reaction on Russia's part. They had clear signals. I think we all saw them, that the U.S., together with, of course, with its British and French sidekicks, Turkey and Saudi Arabia and the GCC were about to launch an overt military regime change operation in Syria. Their attempts to, overthrow it via, Islamist proxies having largely failed over the last 4 years, inconclusive results at best. And they were about to begin an overt Libya-style regime change that would have opened up with Turkish troops moving in and establishing safe havens and no-fly zones and what on, and then progressing to move against Damascus. Russia stepped in, put an end to this, by very noticeably increasing the Russian military presence, which I think right now people are talking a number of around 2,000. These are not combat troops for the most part. There's a small naval infantry unit of about 500 that are there, but that's just to provide security for their base. They do have a sizable amount of aircraft and attack and other helicopters there, some ground-to-air defense systems, and some of the fighters are clearly designed more for air combat, some of the Su-27 flankers, than they are for air-to-ground attack, which means that it is a signal that we will not allow Western or probably even Israeli now airstrikes within Syrian territory any longer. At least territory controlled by the government. So that flushes the West's overt regime change right down the door. And that is what brings us into this UNGA. It changed the complete situation on the ground in Syria. We've had reports that Syrian army, now armed with much better intelligence from the Russian government and advisors on the ground with them, have had some quite successful operations, reversing some losses in just the past week. I expect that trend to continue, and it will certainly provide a great deal of morale. There's a lot of stories coming out of Latakia about how overjoyed the people are. There was a piece on Reuters this week that described people saying that the sound of Russian planes flying overhead in the morning as they were sipping their coffee was a marvelous melody to their ears, because now they have some hope after a quite dismal year. Going into this UNGA speech, of course, Obama is the U.S. government is absolutely furious about this, de facto change in the situation there, and most particularly how Putin is trying to present this as a broad fight against terrorism and ISIL, Going into the UNGA. The United States explicitly blocked a draft resolution for the Security Council by Russia that would classify ISIL as a specific independent terrorist organization and basically encourage all countries to attack this. Evidently, some of the European countries were somewhat amenable to the idea, but the U.S. Outright blocked it because they don't want Putin coming into this UNGA General Assembly speech with the saintly halo of a Security Council resolution backing up what Putin has to say, and it will largely concentrate on Syria and the fight against terrorism and world order.
So there's a few things that are going to be interesting. First of all, Obama is the second speaker after, I assume, Dilma Rousseff. Brazil is the first on the line. And Putin, China is a few after that, so they'll have a whack at whatever Obama says, and probably their extremely tempered diplomatic language, although there's been some movement on that a little bit as of late. And then President Putin will be a few after President Xi. And the context, of course, at the UN Security Council was they did have consensus resolution on fighting terrorism, and the most recent actions by the United States and NATO generally, the zone you spoke about setting up, without the benefit of a UN Security Council resolution or the invitation of the Syrian government, they essentially were going to militarily occupy the northern part of the country and establish some counter-sovereignty to that of the Syrian government that sits at the United Nations. That's a clear violation of international law. They took the additional position that we're going to do airstrikes. We also don't have authority to do that, but we reserve the right, while we're taking airstrikes against terrorists and claiming under the UN resolution, to defend our quote-unquote moderate rebels against the government and strike the government should they attack these terrorists. Eric?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that have to be said. I understand that we want to say again on the record that all of these things are violations of international law, the Geneva Convention, the UN Charter, all of these things. Obviously, I don't think that anybody, any reasonable person would deny all of that. But of course, this is part of a much broader richer historical tradition in recent years, and actually more than just recent years, where the United States takes such unilateral action that is clearly in violation of international law, and it goes against, to a large extent, the world consensus and especially the interests of the U.S. and China. Let us not forget the U.S. bombing of Yugoslavia, of Serbia, especially the bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. All of these are examples. Libya, which, although there was a U.N. Security Council resolution, was done under false pretenses and was essentially basically cajoled, coerced, and lied into accepting the U.S.-NATO position on Libya with U.N. Security Council Resolution 1973, which was supposed to be a no-fly zone, which the U.S. immediately took as essentially an authorization for war. So, excuse me, I think that there's good cause for people and representatives of countries in the Security Council generally to be very wary of what the U.S. wants to do, which is why when there is a resolution as broad and generic as quote-unquote fighting terrorism, sure, everyone can agree. But when it comes to the actual tactical reality of how that will be done, there's certainly no agreement there. And I would point people's attention to a couple of key policy papers that really need to be understood. First one, I think that is quite significant and people should pay attention to, comes from the Brookings Institution in June of this year, and it was entitled Deconstructing Syria. Now, if you want to understand the U.S. strategy, the let's call it the post-2014 strategy for Syria, it is enumerated in the Brookings Institution paper, where they clearly and explicitly explicitly state that the U.S. policy needs to be the de facto partitioning of Syria using quote-unquote humanitarian corridors, using the protection of refugees and the protection of pockets of Syria, quote-unquote, as the pretext for essentially what was already being described there by Mark and by Don, that namely the occupation of certain key areas of northern Syria close to the Turkish border for the purposes of essentially depriving, well, allegedly for fighting ISIS, but depriving the Assad government of any potential to actually liberate any of those territories and to provide protection for the importation of more weapons and more fighters. So I think that this is really an important one. And then we could look historically at Seymour Hersh's research, such as Which Path to Persia from 2007, which laid out the U.S. strategy towards the end of the Bush administration generally, and which has been followed in various forms over the course of the last 8-9 years, which I think illustrates very clearly the U.S. regional hegemonic agenda, which saw Syria as a linchpin of a broader strategy to break the Shia alliance from Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, and to the Hezbollah territory in southern Lebanon.
That the U.S. had created by its regime change in
Correct.
Iraq.
Exactly, exactly. And you see various ways in which the U.S. has done that, not the least of which was the soft coup that pushed Maliki out of power last year in Iraq, which was a major blow to the Iraq-Iran alliance and forced the Iranians into a more active role in fighting against terrorism inside of Iraq directly. You see this in a number of different ways, the blocking of a potential Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline, which was discussed in the months leading up to the beginning of the conflict in Syria in 2011. So there is a regional agenda that the U.S. has been pursuing and continues to pursue. What we've been following over these 4.5 years is the conflict in Syria itself and the way in which it has developed that has forced the U.S. to slightly shift the various tactics that it's using. And now that the Islamic State has come front and center in this conflict, the U.S. and NATO allies want to use that phenomenon, use the terrorism that they themselves have fomented in order to now justify furthering their own agenda. And this is really the crux of the problem, because into the fray now steps Russia to essentially block that agenda by saying and clearly and unmistakably initiating the fight, the real fight against this terrorist surge. And that really puts the brakes on the U.S. agenda for the region, and that is really critical here. And look, let's not make any mistake about it. The Russian direct involvement militarily now in this fight is the reason you've seen a shift in language, a shift in language from President Erdogan in Turkey. It is the reason that these countries such as Turkey and Saudi Arabia are now finally, after 4.5 years, acknowledging that President Assad needs to be part of a political dialogue. That is a major development, one that seemed non-negotiable until the Russians got involved. Now the Russians have sent the clear message to Turkey, to Saudi Arabia, and to Israel that you will need to let us move forward with a political dialogue, or you will find yourselves getting kicked out of this territory.
Hey, Mark, in Moscow, how did the media cover Erdogan's visit last week?
Very lightly. I think the highlight of his visit actually was attending the opening of the Grand Cathedral Mosque in Moscow, which is a very quite an amazing structure built in a Tatar style, but with golden cupolas to reflect the aesthetics of Moscow's own, more prevalent Orthodox churches, of course. It'll seat 10,000. It's really, I think, a very necessary thing, but also a very important statement to have this less than a mile from the Kremlin in the center of Moscow. Erdogan was there along with the president of Kazakhstan, and a boss from Palestine, actually, to open this mosque. And that was really the only significant area that the Russian press really concentrated on Erdogan. Russia has, to a large extent, really played down Turkey's role rhetorically in what's going on because of this TurkStream deal that they have launched to put a pipeline from Russia to Turkey to Europe ever since the EU in the start of the sanctions axed the South Stream that was planned for years, cutting off the gas that they need to themselves. This is kind of spite, castrate. This is a husband who has been cheated on castrating himself to spite his wife.
Clever.
Yeah, really clever. But I have to, that being said, I either think that this whole TurkStream deal with Turkey, which nothing concrete has ever really been signed, is either a bluff on both of their sides that they're both using for leverage with the EU, or an incredible stupidity on the Kremlin's part, because it would rely on a very duplicitous a Turkish regime, which has proved no friend of Russia or to the region, and it would also rely on Turkish-Greek cooperation, which I don't see happening either. Right. So Can I interject
real quick? Two things about that, and partially I want to comment, and partially I want to pose a question back to Mark, if I could. On the one hand, I agree with that. On the other hand, reports indicate that Gazprom has already long since initiated the construction process on the pipeline itself, and they're already building it out into the sea there, into the Black Sea. So the
question, I had missed that.
Right. So the question then becomes, is it stupid policy on Kremlin's part, maybe wishful thinking to, you know, stick a thumb in the eye of Europe, or is the Kremlin using its resources via Gazprom to force either Turkey to follow through with this deal by actually building the infrastructure, or building out the infrastructure and then allowing Turkey or any other potential partner to see the tangible benefits in front of them and force their hand on the position? I don't know. You know, I don't think that the Russians are so stupid that they would invest billions of dollars in building a pipeline if they didn't feel that somebody was going to pick up the other end.
Well, you've got Iran as a possibility there too, right?
Well, again, I mean, I wonder why they would move forward with building the pipeline on their side in their territorial waters if they didn't at least already have an implicit deal in place and or want to create a bidding war.
Yeah, I think that probably a lot of the construction that has already begun could very easily be repurposed for the a foreplanned South Stream.
Could be, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's what I'm saying, is that they might have multiple objectives with building that pipeline infrastructure, not necessarily depending on Turkey to follow through.
Yeah, we'll see on that, but I that's probably getting away from what Don wanted to talk about.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. No, that's all right. I mean, these are the things that are sort of swirling around what's going to happen at the UN. Yeah. But we'll go back to the UN. Let me do this.
Let me ahead, jump in there just a second,
yeah,
Don.
Yeah.
I have a really, I think, a really interesting small little bit of setting the details for this UNGA meeting. That I think are very indicative of what's going on in geopolitics behind the scene. The U.S. president has, whenever he has visited New York for decades, has always stayed at the Waldorf Hotel. In the last year or so, the Waldorf Hotel was bought out by a Chinese company. A Chinese company that everyone assumes has ties with the Chinese government. So the U.S. president is no longer staying at the Waldorf and has moved down the street to a hotel that is owned by the South Koreans. But guess who has no problem staying in a hotel owned by the Chinese. Certainly, of course, their own president will be staying there, Xi Jinping. But also the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, will now be staying in that hotel, as will the Indian and Pakistani prime ministers.
That's interesting.
I think it really says, so we have got, you know, certainly Russia and China most particularly, but also Modi as well, shacking up together before going out and heading into the rhetorical battlefield of the
UN. They're going to have a sleepover?
I think they're going to have a sleepover.
A pillow fight.
Little games, spin the bottle.
You know what else gets me? And this is something that's going to be interesting to watch. Because just the scheduling of the speakers, I assume to an extent Obama is going to be setting the agenda for the items that would be discussed. If he raised something, for example, unexpectedly, an hour or two later when President Xi Jinping speaks, I assume if it's something that they need to address, that the speech will be altered to encompass that to the extent anybody can get caught flat-footed. Likewise with Putin. So let's say items like Ukraine are not mentioned by President Obama. He doesn't take the opportunity to bash Russia over Ukraine.
I don't see that happening.
Right.
I don't expect that either.
I think whatever Obama says on Ukraine, however, I think from what the leaks have been on Putin's speech, that he intends to not address Ukraine at all. The Kremlin is quite happy with the Donbass having settled into a frozen conflict status, and they are not coming here to talk about Ukraine. In fact, Putin and Obama should be meeting earlier on Monday before the UNGA session opens, from what I understand. And they have conflicting reports about who they're both saying that each other asked for the meeting. They're both arguing with each other about what they're going to talk about. The White House says it's going to talk primarily about Russian aggression in Ukraine. The Russian side says it wants to talk primarily about what's going on in Syria, and we'll talk about Ukraine if we have time. But very quite definitely, Russia intends to play down or simply ignore what's happening in Ukraine. As far as at least the Kremlin's foreign policy goals go with the situation as it is there now. But they're coming here to concentrate on Syria, presenting it as a broad-based global fight against terrorism, and to talk about world order, unipolarity, multipolarity, that sorts of thing.
And then we had on Friday, President Xi at the White House, they had a joint conference, Obama and Xi, and you can see some of the tug-of-war back and forth between the two. And again, with China, the very diplomatic way that they couch things, while Obama was talking about China, espionage on the internet for commercial purposes, Xi was used more generic language in terms of talking about the abuse of the internet by various actors, and of course that includes the massive spying operation by the NSA. At least the language allowed for the inclusion of that, but there was no direct reference to it. I wonder, did we get like a little pregame view of what's going to happen at the UN with respect to the U.S. and China?
Yeah, I think so. And I would also say that, I watched some of the coverage. I'll admit I didn't watch it all, but I watched some of the coverage of President Xi in Washington as well as in Seattle. And what I found really interesting about it, and this is an important point, I think, that much of the conversation in the U.S. press, and I would say, those who really do shape a lot of the narrative of the people who matter in the U.S. and in the West, I mean, of course, things like the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, The Economist, some of these publications, they've been talking up a firestorm about China's economy going down the drain, about China's economy being unstable, the stock market, all of these other things in China. And if you saw President Xi Jinping's speech, you noticed that much of what he was talking about was actually countering that narrative. In other words, not only reassuring, but actually, I think, quite forcefully counter-arguing against that narrative, saying that China, despite a decreased growth year on year, is actually still one of the fastest growing economies in the world, that it is tremendously stable. It is clearly and unmistakably still a tremendous cash cow for international investors, still a huge economic growth model that they're employing there. And I think that this is quite significant, because essentially the Chinese government comes to the United States and says, we're not the problem here in this global economy. Let's change the conversation. And I think that that was a really significant moment, because while the Chinese government is officially saying that in the United States, you have all kinds of reports about Chinese-Russian cooperation, not only the Chinese-Russian economic cooperation, but potentially, and this is still quite dubious, I think, but it's possible, potential expanded military cooperation. That is something that is really worrying for the United States and the NATO powers, because as we saw recently with the reports of Chinese naval vessels near Alaskan territorial waters, you saw, of course, Chinese naval vessels engaged with Russian vessels in all kinds of a series of military drills, military exercises, the transfer of S-400 missiles from Russia to China. This growing military cooperation in many ways, I think, dovetails with what China is saying about its economic stability. In other words, China flexes its muscles not with rhetoric, because as Don, you pointed out, and quite right, they always temper their rhetoric in very diplomatic terms, but they're flexing their muscles in other ways. And if China and Russia really kind of represent two sides of the coin there, I think that's how the United States is finally perhaps beginning to wake up to the reality of what multipolarity in this world actually looks like.
You know, there was a statement made by President Obama that was, to me, the most surprising one. I'm going to play it right now. Listen to this. It's about 15 seconds.
Given China's success in lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty, which is one of the most remarkable achievements in human history, we will help rally the world this weekend around new development goals, including our goal to end extreme poverty.
And then he specified a number of areas where they intend to intensify their economic cooperation around the world, which sounded like a pivot to China, as against the kinds of deals that we've heard among the BRICS countries.
Yeah, while the U.S. threatens sanctions on China, imposes sanctions on Venezuela, and all of the other countries that have actually done something about poverty. But I digress.
You're right.
Just before the the meetings, before Xi Jinping actually landed in the United States, or at least got to Washington even, the entire Western press was full of rumors that the U.S. is about to sanction China, supposedly over its cyber activities. This very quietly happened when Obama didn't do this before the meeting. But as was pointed out, while Obama was meeting with the Chinese president, with Xi Jinping, just a few blocks away, Freedom House was hosting a publicity stunt with Chinese dissidents from Hong Kong from this umbrella protest, which, of course, the U.S. quite vociferously insisted they had absolutely nothing to do with a year ago. Well, while the U.S. and Chinese leaders are meeting a few blocks away, a group of U.S. neocons and with some State Department officials is hoving a little PR spot for Chinese dissidents. If you don't think that the Chinese government noticed that, you're naive, the message was quite clear. Whatever is being said, for politeness's sake, for the cameras, to speak, of course, about the economy. That's one thing. But the geopolitical game that's going on behind the scenes is quite clear to me.
Yeah, they might have had they might as well have had a Free Tibet rock concert in earshot right. in earshot of Xi Jinping's speech.
Highlighted by the Dalai Lama. Lama.
Yeah, exactly.
Obama actually
a coterie of good-looking girls. Right.
Obama actually referenced
with Pussy
Tibet.
Riot. Oh, yeah, right. Dalai Lama and Pussy Riot.
Obama actually did reference Tibet, and he made the political concession, I guess, or acknowledged the reality of Tibet being a part of China. That the Tibet is in fact a part of China. However, China should recognize the actual conditions there and speak with the Dalai Lama about the conditions for Tibetans. That was part of what he said. So that was kind of in tandem with what was happening over at Freedom House.
Sure, and certainly, and I wonder if Obama would also suggest that representatives of the plantation slaves have negotiation with the slave masters.
Yeah, right.
Well, it's very interesting. I was at a meeting just 2 weeks ago in Moscow, where there was an NGO here hosting the independence movements from Hawaii and Puerto Rico, who were, of course, since the annexation of Hawaii and the colony status of Puerto Rico, were seeking some rhetorical assistance here in Moscow for their cause. Somehow, I don't think that came up in the discussions with Obama when he was discussing Tibet.
I think the Hawaii thing is somewhat silly, but actually Puerto Rico's independence movement is quite deeply rooted, and I think actually does need to enter into the conversation considering the economic situation of Puerto Rico
and
considering the fact that the U.S. Government, by virtue of some of the legal ramifications and the legal status of Puerto Rico, really has the people there not to be crude, but by the certain part of their anatomy, you know. In other words, the Puerto Rican people are being forced to essentially pay for over-leveraging in terms of investment in bonds the way that the Greek people are being made to pay for the very same transgressions of their own government. And I think that this is actually a very real question and does dovetail with this independence movement for Puerto Rico that's been around for decades. This is not a new phenomenon.
You know, what's interesting is there is a case pending before, I think it's the International Court of Justice, from the indigenous Hawaiian government that apparently has some status, that is a lawsuit against the United States for its occupation of Hawaii. And that case is moving. That case is actually moving.
Yeah, I don't see that going anywhere.
Yeah, it's different because Hawaii is
There's also no real support on the ground for it. Puerto Rico, at least, there is some level of disenchantment there. However, you know, even if we're talking only a third of the population that takes it to that extreme.
Mm. Yeah, but in the region, in UNASUR, for example, there is a great deal of support for Puerto Rican independence. And,
oh, yeah.
And you saw that at the OAS, I think, either CELAC or the OAS, Daniel Ortega allowed a Puerto Rican independista to speak at the podium in his turn.
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of support for it, and I think that the support is obviously designed to, you know, poke the United States in its proverbial eye. But at the same time, I think that there is a growing sense that the discussion about Puerto Rican independence is not simply some kind of an abstraction. And as I mentioned, there are a lot of people now in Puerto Rico, more so than before. Look, Puerto Ricans have always supported the status only to the extent that it benefited them economically. Now, if Puerto Rico's economic collapse can be directly linked, as I think it can and should be, to its relation to U.S. policy, I think that you could see a very significant shift in public opinion. And remember, the people who support Puerto Rico remaining with the United States, many of them are coming to the United States. So who's left in Puerto Rico? Well, I think it's quite obvious.
And then you have also, first, the legal fact that the U.S. Claim on Puerto Rico, it has been, I think, since the 40s, subject to the UN, the whole decolonization process at the UN. And in addition to that, the issue in Puerto Rico, of course, is this sovereign debt issue. Now, the issue of sovereignty is a little fuzzy, but we know how the UN General Assembly breaks on that because of the Argentinian proposal last year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much international support you're really going to get for something like that, considering they know what the implications would be for relations with the United States if they come out vocally on that issue. But I'm at the same time, you know, as you mentioned, and quite correctly, Latin America is pretty much unified on the issue. If the U.S. pushes far enough, you could start to see some BRICS countries chiming in on that. Although, again, I don't think that the Chinese and or the Russians necessarily see Puerto Rico as even close to the top of the list of priorities. So, no. You know, it's sort of a, I think, a peripheral issue at best.
Yeah, it's a thumb in the eye. So let me, having created that segue myself, which I deeply apologize for,
it's okay.
let me draw us back to the main questions of the right. UNGA and what's going on in Syria. And let's pull Europe into this.
Right.
Because some very interesting things that I observed during the week is that I noticed in a report quoting U.S. officials in foreign policy that they said that the Obama administration was pressured by several of his European allies to meet with Putin while Putin is in New York for the UNGA meeting. On top of that, you have Merkel this week making a quite direct about-face and saying...
Mark, you're saying who pressured the U.S. to do that?
The European uh-huh. allies. Okay. This is what foreign policy claimed. Explicitly, right. They said okay. this. It was in an article on the U.S. stonewalling of this Russian resolution on Syria before going into the UNGA. On top of this, Merkel made a real about-face on Syria, said that Russian help was needed, and that basically dropping that Assad must go, this chant coming out of the West, at least at the beginning of any type of reconciliation or peace process about what's going on in Syria. And then just a few hours ago, David Cameron came out and said that the UK welcomes Russian efforts to combat ISIL in Syria. So what we may be seeing is a little bit of a European revolt, to some extent, perhaps, against the harder position coming out of the White House over Russia and Russia's fight involvement in Syria. And I think that, again, ties in with some disenchantment over how the events have played out in Ukraine and how the events have played out in Syria, particularly in with regard to this, shall we say, far refugee crisis that has seen so many Syrians and many other refugees and immigrants pouring into Europe and destabilizing their own both national and supranational political system there so terribly over the last few weeks. I think Europe is starting to really be disenchanted with Obama, and they know that he's soon to leave office and is a lame duck. So they're having some pushback, and they're making, I think, some signals to Russia of re-engagement. Now, I hope that Russia, and I believe the Kremlin, is smart enough to take these with a grain of salt. And whatever, we may see some reconciliatory gestures out of Obama during his speech, but I don't believe for a second that the U.S. Will give up on its regime change goals in Syria in the long term. It will simply be a, okay, you've won this round, Russia, but we could see another type of provocation, some accusations of chemical weapons use down the road in another year or two after perhaps ISIL has been certainly more sufficiently degraded than supposed strong U.S. efforts have failed to do in the last year.
There's an interesting contradiction that's developed in the Western narrative with the if you take the Western narrative about the refugee crisis at face value, which is what's been peddled to the people in Europe who were facing this influx of refugees, certainly. You know, this is the result of the war in Syria. They blame Assad on the one hand, but the mechanical process of cutting off the stream, of course, has become evident to everyone, must involve the government of Syria. And so that creates a kind of interesting dead end for that narrative.
I thought it was really generous of Merkel to grant the president of Syria some small role, at least in the future destiny of his country. I thought that was really generous of the Reichschancellor.
Yeah, she's just a great leader there, isn't she?
Yeah.
Eric, what do
downright
you think?
Downright benevolent. I think that, yes, and look, as I mentioned already, and I don't want to repeat myself, but I think it needs to be reiterated. One of the number one belligerents in this conflict in Syria has been Turkey since 2011. And the fact that Erdogan, who is probably the most hawkish on the Syria issue of anybody, that Erdogan is now talking about Assad being part of a political dialogue process, along with the Saudis beginning to, you know, say things of that nature as well. I think this tells you that we have now seen a monumental shift in the conflict in Syria generally and the politics around the conflict.
At least in the short term, yes.
Specifically. And I think that that is directly attributable to Russia's activity in Syria.
Absolutely.
Look, we just had a meeting of Prime Minister Netanyahu in Moscow. And, although it's always, you know, depicted as very cordial and Putin is always such a nice guy when he speaks to Netanyahu, et cetera, you read between the lines. And I think it's quite obvious that the Russians basically delivered a very clear and unmistakable message that the days of Israeli free reign in Syria's airspace are over, that the Syrians are not going to be bombed by Israeli jets while Russian troops and Russian military advisors and Russian people are inside of Syria.
Especially Russian air defense.
Right. And specifically Russian air defense. That's what I was going to get to. Namely, that the Russians will act to shoot down any aircraft in Syrian airspace not cleared by the Assad government and not discussed with the Russians. In other words, Israeli jets will be shot down by Syrian and or Russian air defenses if it comes to that. In other words, Netanyahu's war against Hezbollah will only be restricted to Lebanon. This war will be no longer exist in Syria as long as the Russians are there. That's a major, major development, because remember, the Israelis have been providing medical aid to the Al-Qaeda terrorists of the Al-Nusra front. This we know. This has been reported by the United Nations. But although it's been reported by the media, it's quite buried, I would say, in the avalanche of news about Syria, the fact that the Israelis have bombed Syria more than a dozen times. On many occasions,
yes.
They have run sorties into Syria, bombing both Hezbollah targets and Syrian army targets. This has been reported in many news outlets. So
in Israel, Haaretz reports on it regularly. I think Netanyahu actually issues press releases about it.
They're not ashamed of it.
I think Tel Aviv issues press releases about it because it's something that supports their government locally.
Right. And so the fact that the Russians are now there and basically dictating to the Israelis that the era where they can do that is over, that is also significant. And that is a message to Turkey. That's a message to Saudi Arabia. That's a message to the United States. And so the shifting of this discussion, the parameters of this discussion, is directly attributable to what Russia is doing. And I think that there's a couple of things I would say in relation to that. Number one, it demonstrates that Russia's back, baby. Namely, namely that Russia is back in terms of flexing its military muscle. We all know that the Russians have a penchant for, strong talk, making statements that might be seen as far more, let's call it confrontational than their Chinese partners or really anybody else in the world. But now Russia's actually making tangible moves on the ground. And that is significant, far more significant than a tiny little foothold at Tartus. Now you're talking about a direct Russian, Syrian, Iranian, Hezbollah military alliance. And that is a major, major shift. And I think that that is sending shockwaves around the world. And nobody is really wanting to discuss it publicly. But remember, the Russians are now moving forward with transferring S-300s to Iran, finally, after years of delay. The Russians are doing the same in Syria. The Russians are now opening their arms exports more and more so to these countries. When that happens, remember, aside from oil, arms exports is Russia's number two economic driver.
Iran just agreed to buy another $21 billion worth of Russian arms this week.
So. Yeah, and they're transferring everything from air defense systems to helicopters to, small arms, everything. This is now a huge, watershed moment for the entire region as Russia reinserts itself, probably for the first time since the 1980s, since the Soviet Union.
You know, not only that, you mentioned the final transfer of the S-300s to Iran. Of course, you have the war in Yemen going on with Saudi Arabia as proxy, with the U.S. command and control of the airstrikes into that country that have been going on since March. Iran backing the People's Committees and the Yemeni army, the actual Yemeni army, in fighting off the Saudis, who have tried also to do ground invasion. They were repelled. The Yemenis have actually gone inside Saudi Arabia several times.
Yes, that's been very quietly kept out of the media.
And then, of course, you've had the two catastrophes at the Hajj in front of the entire Islamic world. And a discussion of Saudi Arabia's custody of Mecca and of the entire major part of the Islamic religious practice.
And there's also the almost entirely unreported story about the death of the son of the Emir of the United Arab Emirates, or one of the leaders in the United Arab Emirates. This death, which they're now attributing to, he's 33 years old or something. His death they're attributing to, quote unquote, a heart attack or heat stroke or some natural cause. But actually, there are a lot of rumors swirling in the region and in certain quarters in international press that he was actually killed by a Yemeni strike on the Saudi forces that he was visiting. So now you have the withdrawal of the United Arab Emirates troops that are part of that coalition. And I have that from a source that's actually somewhat close to the Saudi royal family. They're really concerned about this so-called coalition that they developed, even among their GCC allies, collapsing. And
this is a major story
in the United Arab Emirates, and it's almost totally removed from the Western narrative.
And then there's also the letter by members of the Saudi royal family calling for the removal of the king, the crown prince, and the deputy crown prince. And they mentioned specifically Yemen over that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of rumors, letters swirling about of dissension within the House of Saud, wanting to remove King Salman, that his policies of this war in Yemen, adding to the war in Syria, the aggressiveness is leading to and the pumping the oil prices into the ground with overproduction led to severe problems for the kingdom.
And
on top of that, we've got a Saudi prince who is now being accused of sexual assault charges on five women in one day in the United States. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the House of Saud has got only five. Yeah, only five in a single day.
It was a slow day
for the House of Saud. The House of Saud was granted the chairmanship of the UN Human Rights Committee this week, right, which the U.S. State Department explicitly welcomed, this coming only days after Saudi Arabia announced that it would crucify and then behead a political dissident, a Shia, whose only crime is political protest against them. I thought that was really sweet.
And that committee, let me describe that committee. Hang on a sec, Eric. Eric, let me describe that committee, because the committee we're talking about of the Human Rights Council is the committee that appoints the experts that go into places where there are allegations of human rights abuse and then issue the reports for the Human Rights Council and the Security Council. It's a very key committee. It's the key committee. It sets the tone for all of the investigations.
That's right. And remember that it was the UN Human Rights Council that was the major source of information leading up to the UN Security Council resolution against Libya. It was the Human Rights Council, yes, that was making the major statements that were used against Gaddafi. It is the Human Rights Council that has made some of the major statements regarding Syria and remained completely silent or almost completely silent about Yemen. So, yeah.
Silent about the bombing of civilians in Ukraine.
And Ukraine, exactly.
North Korea.
Right. They've issued also the reports on North Korea that paint North Korea as this, you know, rogue, murderous, horrible place.
Yeah. Right. So, I think, Don, you're very much correct that it is an important position. And I would also say, too, that one thing that they don't discuss is Saudi Arabia. And I think that is probably unlikely to come up on the agenda now that Saudi Arabia is heading that committee. So, yes, I think it is important, and I think it indicates something else. And this is maybe one of these unintended consequences that more and more I think that countries are really again, returning to this question of the actual structure of the UN, because remember, we've had this move over the course of the last couple of years to reevaluate India's position, Pakistan's position, some of these other rising countries that are major players in terms of population, that are increasingly important economically and politically, and then at the same time reevaluating just how important is France, just how important is the UK. And these permanent members of the Security Council being this vestige of the post-World War II era, the post-World War II world, that increasingly now changing people's perceptions, changing. And I think that this human rights issue hopefully reignites this conversation about the structure of the UN and who dictates how the UN actually operates.
Right, we've got 5 minutes left. And one point on that I think I'd like to cover as we wrap it up. Is the call by Samantha Power last week essentially to either strip Russia of its veto power or have it be constrained in its use, to look outside, essentially a more than implicit threat, to look outside the structures of the UN, ignoring the UN charter that the U.S. signed as the primary authority on international conflicts.
Yeah, of course, this is all a little bit ridiculous rhetoric. Samantha Powers can say all she wants. The U.S. having used the veto so many times to shield Israel and the Israeli occupation of Palestine from the world, the real international community, it's a little bit laughable coming out of the United States with, just the recent developments in Ukraine. Evidently, Poroshenko is really going to be harping at this when he's at the UNGA and no one is really paying any attention to what he's saying. But I don't think we should take it too seriously. Reform of the UN, we can all talk about it. It would be wonderful and in a happy world, but very little is going to come of it. Even a Indian seat on the Security Council is years away, and I don't think there'll be any broader reform. We do live in a realist world of great powers, and the Security Council is still necessary to represent that reality. I don't necessarily even believe in democratization. I don't believe that the Republic of Palau should have the same say in the world as Russia or China.
Yeah, but so. I just got to say, though, I mean, is France a great power? I think that's debatable.
No. It certainly is. I would love to see France and the both the France and the UK rolled into one EU vote. That's not going to happen, unfortunately, not in the near future.
To the extent that they extent that they have an independent policy, independent of NATO, I don't know.
I don't see any serious change in that kind of structure.
I agree. I just mean that the conversation as it pertains to Saudi Arabia and the U.S. position on that, it does reignite that question about how the U.N. operates.
And in the next minute and a half or two, bringing the AU to a seat, making an EU seat, first of all, because Germany should have at least an equal voice inside that to the UK and France, and then say an UNASUR voice so that, the whole world were represented there.
The Islamic world, however much I may not like it, and who will probably get the voice, but the Islamic world too certainly deserves the GCC, a representation
or something. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I want to close just stressing again this huge shift, not only on reality of the ground in Syria, but geopolitically in the world, with Russia's decisive move in the face of a U.S. administration whose policies have failed in Syria, who evidently is at war, in a name-calling war with its own CIA and its own military chiefs, with the former head of the CIA and the general calling for an open U.S. alliance with al-Qaeda now David Petraeus to overthrow the government in Syria, while the president shoots back at the CIA that it didn't really want to support any rebels from the beginning there in Syria. Putin steps into this decisively without any warning and changes the reality on the ground with while it is a use of military, we haven't seen any bombings or even airstrikes yet. This is using military as a smart diplomatic tool. And Eric talked about it. It's a very, very important. According to the U.S. press, there were meetings in Baghdad this week. Military and intelligence coordination of Iraq, Iran, Syria, Russia, Hezbollah, and I think we can all agree that China is at the least a silent partner in all of this. This is a big geopolitical shift. It signals that not only is Russia back in the Middle East, but that they are not going to take this aggressive attempt by the U.S. to maintain their hegemony there any longer.
And I would just add real quickly as well, I know we're out of time, but Don brought up the African Union and Mugabe coming to the UN. This is also significant because under Mugabe, who is clearly and unmistakably the most vocal leader anywhere in Africa as it pertains to issues of imperialism generally. And
now that Gaddafi's gone.
Right. Well, now that Gaddafi's gone. This is important because Mugabe, even though he's so advanced in years, he is actually a highly respected voice on the African continent, and a lot of Africa listens to what he says. And the fact that the African Union obviously sees the same thing that we're seeing, a shifting geopolitical reality, they understand that this has a direct impact on the African continent as well, where they've seen Chinese economic penetration being checked and blocked by U.S. military penetration. So Africa as a geopolitical battlefield is really important, and the leadership in Africa is also very, very significant. So countries like Zimbabwe and Eritrea and a number of others that have been demonized repeatedly by the United States, they obviously look towards China. Increasingly, formerly staunch U.S. allies are looking towards China, specifically Uganda and Ethiopia, who have been seen as U.S. proxies for a long time. They're also increasing their relations with China and, by extension, the BRICS non-Western world. There is a shifting geopolitical reality in Africa in addition to that in the Middle East. And I think that the United States is tremendously fearful of all of these developments.
Guys, thank you very much. A pleasure as always. Eric Dreitzer, Mark Sloboda. Talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Don.
Look forward to it.
Thanks. This has been CPR Sundays from Community Public Radio in New York. I'm Don DeBar. See you next week.